Amen. As I was listening to the young people sing, I actually feel like I know something. I was going, hey, that's harmony. That's what was going on back there. So I was kind of proud of myself that I recognized that. So they did an awesome job. Man, that was just great. Beautiful, and beautiful song, too. You guys like history, right? I'm glad, because we got a lot of it today. You may get more than you want today. I don't know. But go to Hebrews chapter 12, and we're going to look at these two mountains. Mountains are a big deal to not only Christians, but particularly the Israelites in the Old Testament. Psalm 121 speaks about looking to the heavens, to the mountains, and putting one's trust in God. Why? Because mountains are, they're like, you know, majestic and big, and it's like they're just so like, oh, and wow. And it's not that we look at the mountains and say, oh, we're going to put our trust in the mountains. When we look at the mountains, we go, well, God created those, and those don't move around every day. And so when we see the stability and majesty of the mountains, it reminds us of how awesome our God is. So that's what Psalm 121 was speaking about in some respects. And then even in the New Testament, Jesus took Peter, James, and John up on top of the mountain. Apparently, mountaintop experiences are valid experiences. We think as we get closer up there, there's something spiritual going on. I was reading about a preacher that went to Nigeria, and he got a particular young man to give him a tour and walk up this particular mountain in Nigeria. And the guy would only go so far. He said, oh, I can't go any further. And he said, why is that? He said, oh, because the gods live up there. Well, that's kind of the feeling people have had during history, that there's something spiritual going on up there. But the Bible also paints this picture that the majesty of the mountains speaks about the sovereignty of God. And, of course, it was that place on top of two majestic mountains in a certain way that God speaks to us today in Hebrews chapter 12. Let's read there. Verse 18, you have not come to a mountain that can be touched, and that is burning with fire and darkness and gloom and storm, the trumpet blast, or to such a voice speaking words that those who heard it begged that no further word be spoken to them, because they could not bear what was commanded. Even if an animal touches the mountain, it must be stoned to death. The sight was so terrifying that Moses said, I am trembling with fear. But you have come to Mount Zion, the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. See to it that you do not refuse him who speaks. If they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, how much less will we if we turn away from him who warns us from heaven? At that time his voice shook the earth, but now he has promised, once more I will shake not only the earth but also the heavens. The words once more indicate the removing of what can be shaken, that is, created things, so that what cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful and so worship God acceptably and with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. A lot of Christians, they'll read that text and just kind of run right through it, and but you know, if you were in the audience in the first century listening to the writer, the book of Hebrews, this epistle is really just one long sermon. If you were listening to his sermon, and he got to chapter 12, and he's talking about these two mountains, it's a big, big deal to you. It's like if a Jewish person then, and even many of them now, if they have two strings to pull on their heart, these would be the two. One would be Mount Zion, and one would be Mount Sinai. It's like two pillars of Judaism. And so he is contrasting them for their benefit. Because remember, these guys and ladies, they grew up Jewish. They grew up in the temple. They grew up in the synagogue. And then the gospel was preached to them. And then they believed. Many of them believed. They came to know the Lord. And so things changed drastically for them in their faith, because they used to be involved with all this stuff in the temple worship and in the synagogue, with all of the vestiges, with all the nuances, with the smell of the incense, all this kind of thing that was going on. And after they were saved, now they were meeting maybe in a little house, 5, 6, 10, 15 other believers around a kitchen table. There's none of that stuff that they grew up with. It's so simple now. So they're thinking, can it really be that simple? Maybe we need to go back and accumulate some of these things that we were raised with. Maybe we're really missing out on some spirituality with God. And the writer's saying, no, no, no. He's saying everything you're thinking about going back to is like Mount Sinai. Can't go back there. And so he revisits Mount Sinai so that he can point them to Mount Zion. Now, we all understand Mount Sinai. We understand that that's the place where God gave the Ten Commandments to Moses. And it was a place of fear. Everybody was cowered down, face down. God said, you can go to this certain place around the perimeter of the mountain there in Saudi Arabia, and you can go no further. Otherwise, you'll die. In other words, God said, keep your distance from me. It's a place of darkness, gloom. The text uses that word, fear, dread, lightning, thunder, all these things that would make you afraid. My dog Buster would have been deathly afraid there. We bought a balloon for Luke's birthday. He's scared to death of the balloon, hiding behind the couch. Buster, it's okay. Took me 30 minutes just to try to warm him up to the balloon. But at Mount Sinai, it was much worse than a balloon. It was incredible that Moses saw the backside of God and lived to tell about it. The writer's saying, man, you don't want to go back there. You want to go back to where God says, keep your distance. And so he contrasts that with Zion, Mount Zion. What is Mount Zion? It was about 12 years ago that I really heard for the first time the concept of Zionism. In Psalm 65, verse 1, praise awaits you, our God, in Zion. Not only is Mount Sinai a huge deal to Israelites and to Israelis, for many of them today, but Zion is a huge deal. Big deal. Where is Zion? What is Zion? What is Zionism? It's really important that we understand that. You won't appreciate the news. unless you understand Zionism. Because it is coming out in the news every single day. What you're seeing, what you're witnessing, when they're speaking about Israel and this rift in particular with the president and Netanyahu, it comes from Zionism. Now, when you're thinking about Mount Sinai, you got to go back 3,500 years. But then Israel, they don't do what they're supposed to do, and so they go into exile with the Babylonians. And then, as God prophesied, Cyrus, the Persian, gives them the right to go back and rebuild the temple with Zerubbabel, and he took about 50,000 with him. Then later, Nehemiah and Ezra come, they can rebuild the wall and Jerusalem. And so there are some of them there. Many of them are not. As we look at the book of Esther, many of them did not want to come home because there was not much there, and they had businesses and were making money and were profitable in other places, which is probably why the name of God is not mentioned in Esther. It's an indictment, because they should have come home. They didn't, but there were many that were there. And so then the Romans later came, and as you know, they conquered the land. And so they were under that rule. The second temple was built under Herod during the time that Jesus came. And then 70 AD, of course, the Romans destroyed all of that. And then in about 130, 135, Bar Kokhba, he claimed himself to be Messiah and revolted against the Romans. And they finally said, "We've had it. We're going to put this rebellion down." And then they made all the Jews aliens from all of Judea. Said, "You guys got to leave. You can't live here anymore." So they were just totally thrown out of their homeland. So the church age goes by, and centuries, they undergo a lot of persecution. You can get into the Crusades, and a lot's going on there. The Inquisition, a lot of them die. It's just, you know, a sad story. In Europe, during the... they didn't really get a foothold of thinking that they were a real people until in France, right around the time of Napoleon. And France said, "You can come out of the ghettos and you can live like normal people." And then Britain caught on, and later Germany and some other countries. But then the Enlightenment progressed, and anti-Semitism began to increase all over again. And there were many people, many rabbis who had spoken about Zionism. But it really wasn't until Theodor Herzl, in around 1896-98, he kind of was able to the glue that put everything together in order for Zionism to really get started in its first major wave. And so what Zionism was for Jewish people, it was really about coming home. They knew that God had promised them this land. And so they wanted to come home, and they wanted to get the other Jews around the world to want to do the same. Theodor Herzl, after he saw a massacre occur in France, this was the catalyst that got him to really making this movement more substantial and organizing it, because he said to himself, "We need to get a place where Israel can survive and hopefully maybe someday thrive." So Zionism for him and many others was coming back to Judea and Jerusalem and the surrounding area and reestablishing Israel as a state, or establishing them, I should say, as a state, reestablishing them as a nation, so that they could have a place where they wouldn't be persecuted and they could live like other people. Now, not all the Jewish people were for that. There were many Orthodox Jewish people who were against it. In fact, the largest group in Judaism was against it. Now, why would they be against that? Why would they be against Israel going back home, establishing a state, having a place of safety and security so that they could carry on with their lives? Because many of the Orthodox Jews believe that they shouldn't impose their will and by force or coercion or that kind of thing to establish a state of Israel, that they should instead trust in God and trust that the Messiah would come one day and do that for them. So they should wait on the Messiah. Of course, they didn't believe in Christ. They're talking about the Messiah, what we talk about in the second coming, they would speak about in the first coming. So they were against it. There are many other factions in Judaism. Some of them were socialistic, even some of them were communistic. But many of them obviously were democratic, and obviously that is the one that was able to prevail. So Herzl, he ushered this thought of Zionism in, and so it began to have this wave that started. He died several years later, but the wave kept going, and then Britain, of course, was in control of that area. And so they began to have dialogue with the Britons and others about establishing this place. There were many Jews who said, it's never going to happen. You're just fooling yourself. Nobody's ever going to give us this land back. So World War I occurred. Some of the Jews came back. They were living there in Israel along with the Arabs who had planted their roots there since the Jews had been kicked out in 135. And but still, World War I did not make the cause the progress to occur that we later saw through World War II. As a result of the Holocaust, the treaty there of Balfour and with the United Nations after World War II, they established the State of Israel in 1948. This is the only known occurrence of an ancient civilization reestablishing itself in modern day. This has never happened before. And it happened in one day. The Bible prophesied that this would happen in one day. And so Israel became a nation. The question was, and there were other people who were against this because of the way they did it. The first prime minister of Israel back in 48, his name was Ben Gurion. A lot of Jews liked him, a lot didn't. He was a pragmatist. There were a lot of Jews that said, we don't want this deal unless we get all of the promised land. He said, no. He said, if we get all of the promised land, if we get all of the West Bank, then we'll get, and we become democratic, we'll get outvoted by all the Arabs. So he was willing to make the deal over getting Israel by just getting part of the land so that they could become democratic and rule themselves and not be outvoted by the Arabs that lived there. Well, one of the guys, well, I should say the, well, he's one of the men that was against him was Menachem Begin. He became the next prime minister. Menachem Begin wanted the whole thing. He wanted the whole enchilada. And it was all a moot point, though, because not only were they attacked, you know, the week or weeks after they became a nation by what, Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and somebody else, I don't remember. But later on in 1967, you remember the Six-Day War.